From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. When George W. Bush declared war on Iraq, he pledged continued support to building infrastructure, stability and peace in Afghanistan. It was a tall order, and the Afghan people are asking when it will be met. The rubble of America's last war is still smoldering under gunfire and insecurity. A year and a half after the Taliban were overthrown, the US-backed interim president, Hamid Karzai, is mocked as the mayor of Kabul for his limited power. Outside the capital, warlords rule by violence, intimidation, and the backing of US dollars. Miles from the Kabul safe zone, Sarah Chase, former NPR correspondent, now field director of an Afghan non-profit organization, has been working on the construction of housing and community radio in the former Taliban stronghold of Kandahar in the southeast of the country. In a New York Times op-ed piece today, Sarah Chase accused the Bush administration of hedging its bets by supporting both Karzai and the warlords who challenge his authority. Tonight on Point, befriending the enemy of our enemy in Afghanistan again. We begin tonight in Kandahar, where former NPR correspondent Sarah Chase has been based as Kandahar director for the non-profit organization Afghans for Civil Society. She's the author of Afghanistan's Future Lost in the Shuffle, which appeared in the New York Times op-ed pages today. I asked her who runs Kandahar now.
Who mostly runs Kandahar now is the governor, who took power actually against Hamid Karzai's wishes. And he did this by invading the city after the Taliban fell. In other words, the Taliban fell. Mr. Karzai asked this governor to stay outside the city, and he refused to do that. He invaded the town with his own gunmen and in that way imposed himself, basically because Karzai was not interested in having yet another bloodbath here. So this is the guy who basically runs towns. Power is a little bit divided. There are some other bases of power, but essentially he's the one who runs it.
There's been a lot of discussion about the power which various regional warlords in Afghanistan are still able to exert. Is this governor somebody whom you would characterize as a warlord?
Very much so. Very much so. And what's really amusing is then he will say, when he's got visitors from abroad, he will say to them, oh, the warlords have to be disarmed. You know, we can't have elections until the warlords are disarmed. So he's very much learned how to talk the talk. But you have to look at what he's actually doing. He was the governor before the Taliban came. And it was because of the violence and murder and arbitrary oppression, really, of the people that caused them to welcome the Taliban as a respite.
You say that he is there against the wishes of the interim president, against the wishes of Mr. Karzai. Is that because he has more local support? He is a more legitimate local leader than the candidate of the center, of Kabul itself?
Absolutely not. The opposite is true. In fact, he has very little local support, but he was able to impose himself by the power of the gun. Because he was one of these allies of convenience, I guess you could say, of the Americans in the war against the Taliban, he received a lot of weapons, a lot of materiel, and a lot of money. And that's what enabled him to impose himself. And this is true in a number of other provinces around the country.
There is a very clear confusion here, isn't there? On the one hand, Interim President Karzai is very much a man backed by the United States. On the other hand, you have here one regional warlord, and as you say, others elsewhere in the country as well, who you say are also backed by the US. Now, how can both of these things be true?
It beats me. And in fact, it confuses a lot of Kandaharis who ask me the same thing. They say, we don't understand the Americans. Why are they supporting President Karzai and supporting the enemies of President Karzai at the same time? Now, at the time that this governor was able to impose himself, I was reporting. And I was also very baffled at this. And the only explanation I could find was the involvement of Pakistan. Because this governor is definitely Pakistan's man. And my only plausible deduction at the time was that Pakistan was basically asking for payback for being part of the so-called anti-terror coalition. And basically Pakistan's price, or one of Pakistan's prices, was the installation of their guy in Kandahar.
What is the effect of this very murky political power play, then, on the people of Kandahar themselves and on the city itself? Is it, would you say now, despite all these difficulties, a relatively well-run city?
Not at all. It's not a well-run city at all. There's a huge amount of hope and energy and vitality that you see in the city. There's an enormous amount of activity. Artisans are working. Kids are going to school. All of these things. But the level of disillusionment and disappointment is really painful to watch, actually. And you get a certain feeling of kind of despair at the same time, that people don't really know where to turn, because they feel like on a local level, their government is locked up, and they feel like the enormous power of the Americans, which is felt simply by the presence of American troops, on the one hand, it does keep the lid on violence, so there's not rivers of blood running in the streets. On the other hand, they feel like this American presence, insofar as it supports the governor, is blocking any substantive advance in the reconstruction of the country. So they kind of feel like their hands are tied. So on the one hand, they pursue their everyday lives with this incredible energy. And on the other hand, you see them kind of shrugging their shoulders and withdrawing their life force from the reconstruction process.
Sarah, in the aftermath of the attacks of September the 11th, 2001, the Americans went into Afghanistan and struck up allegiances with some of these people on the basis that they could help get rid of the Taliban. They might very well be able to help to find Osama bin Laden. What now is the relationship between the kinds of warlords that you've just been discussing and those remnants of the Taliban who are still in Afghanistan?
I think that's an excellent question, because the sort of explanation of convenience, again, is that, well, yeah, these guys aren't very good, but at least they're helping us fight the Taliban. What I have witnessed here is that there's actually an objective alliance between these governors, or at least between this one in this province, and the Taliban themselves. In other words, it's through continuing lawlessness and extremist activity that these governors, or this governor, gets paid, maintains his alliance with the Americans, is allowed to run the province under a kind of martial law, can send his soldiers out to basically feed off the countryside. So for him to eradicate the Taliban completely is against his economic interests, quite simply. So what he does is he allows them in, and then once they're in and do something, then he'll, with great bombast, send out his soldiers and supposedly hunt them down. So it's a kind of very cynical playing with a faucet, opening the valve a little bit to let people in, and then, you know, showing with a lot of enthusiasm that he's closing the valve. And unfortunately, that kind of Machiavellian activity is a little bit difficult for Americans to read sometimes, particularly ones who haven't been here very long. So it works. And so far from being a kind of expedient in the war against the Taliban, governors like the one in Kandahar are actually the largest source of instability and extremist activity in Kandahar.
But do you believe, from what you see there day to day, that the American administration, the American military, would be able to do something about this if they decided that that was what they wanted to do?
Absolutely. I don't think, again, this is a common argument that, oh, you know, these warlord governors have the support of the countryside, or they would fight if they were dismissed. I don't see any evidence of that. I actually see an enormous amount of evidence that at least this one is reviled, is detested by the countryside, and with the slightest visible display that the American forces are backing a central government decision to dismiss him, he would go without a peep. He would go without a squeak, and so would his henchmen, because they watched, you know, they watched the bombing campaign against the Taliban. They know what the American military is capable of. And in this country, deterrence goes a long way. Threat of force, if it's massive force, is usually enough to deter rebellion.
Is there not, though, an argument that goes along these lines, that if you were to dislodge these local warlords, they would simply take to the mountains, they would become another armed group of rebels, they would cause continuing instability, continuing violence for the foreseeable future?
I don't think that's a plausible argument, as I said, because the threat of American retaliation is so terrifying that they wouldn't take it on. I don't think they would take it on.
What do people in Kandahar say, then, about the way in which the American administration is handling this particular issue, the way in which the American administration now regards Afghanistan altogether?
Well, the first part of your question, I think the Afghans and certainly the Kandaharis, who are the ones I'm the most familiar with, they're utterly baffled because from their perspective, it's clear as a bell that it was the Americans who installed, in the Afghan view, these warlord governors. At the same time, the Afghans also see that the Americans are backing President Karzai. So they just don't understand the logic of this policy. They simply don't understand the logic. As far as the sort of concern that the Americans are losing interest in Afghanistan, I think that is always a live concern. But on the ground here, it's not that evident. In other words, at the airport just south of Kandahar, there are still between 3,000 and 5,000 American troops. So the sort of pull of the American attention away from Afghanistan and toward Iraq and other crises is not that manifest on the ground.
Do you believe that at some point it might be possible to integrate these warlords into an overarching centralized Afghan government, to bring them into a single government structure, for them to become loyal to President Karzai and to become, in a sense, regional governors in the way that many other countries have regional governors?
I don't believe that these particular guys who are currently holding these positions are reformable. I think that they have lived for so long on a corrupt and violent governing style that it's not going to be possible to train them out of it or convince them out of it. It's simply not in their interest to reform. I mean, it might be in their long-term interest if there were a credible threat of dismissing them otherwise, but that threat hasn't been made credible to them yet. And I just don't think they understand the notion of governance as anything other than essentially the plunder for personal purposes of their province. Not to mention the fact that many of them are simply war criminals. So it's sort of like saying, do you think Slobodan Milosevic could be trained into being a decent president of Bosnia? I just don't think it's a prospect that we would impose on any country other than Afghanistan. I don't think we would consider that to be an acceptable prospect in Europe, for example.
So in your eyes then, Sarah, the only way forward that you can see is for these guys to be dislodged, to be removed from power, and for that to happen, it requires President Karzai, with what you suggest seems to be very obvious American backing, to say to them, you are out.
Quite precisely. That's precisely how I see it. And I don't think, until that's done, honestly, I don't think anything else really matters. You know, the notion, we're talking about an electoral process coming up. The notion that you could hold an election in this country that would mean anything with these guys still in control of the countryside is just crazy. And I think to claim to be democratic countries that would foster an electoral exercise under these conditions, to me, would disillusion Afghans with the whole idea of democracy. They would say, if this is your guys' idea of democracy, well, we don't, you know, it doesn't make any sense to us. So I really think that almost any other major project in this country is almost valueless until this step is taken.
Sarah Chase, thank you very much indeed for talking with us.
Thank you, Robin. It's always a pleasure.
Sarah Chase is Kandahar Director of Afghans for Civil Society, and she spoke to us from Kandahar. To read Sarah's op-ed piece from today's New York Times, you can visit our website on pointradio.org. We're talking about U.S. policy in Afghanistan and its continued support for regional warlords. You can join our conversation, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Robin Lustig. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the U.S. commitment to rebuilding Afghanistan. Is the Bush administration getting it wrong? Having won the war, does backing the warlords mean that it could lose the peace? Is the U.S. hedging its bets? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Well, joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Ambassador Bill Taylor, Afghanistan Coordinator of the U.S. State Department. Ambassador, thanks very much indeed for joining us this evening.
Thank you, Robin.
And joining us from Baltimore, Maryland is Kayum Karzai, brother of the interim Afghan President Hamid Karzai and founder and director of Afghans for Civil Society. Mr. Karzai, thank you, too, for being with us.
I'm glad to be here, Robin.
Mr. Ambassador, let me ask you a question that Sarah Chase just asked. Why is the U.S. supporting both Interim President Karzai and his enemies?
The U.S. is not supporting President Karzai's enemies. Let me be very clear. We support this president in Afghanistan, and we support his administration, and we do not support any of the governors or any of the local commanders who do not support this president. It is true, as Sarah indicated, that during the war, I think you indicated this as well, Robin, that during the war to dislodge and kick out the Taliban and Al-Qaeda from Afghanistan, we picked allies. We had some allies that that supported us at the time. We supported them at the time. Some of these people are now in power in various places around the country. And some of these people support the president and some people don't. And those that don't, we don't support. Those that do, we do.
And some of them received very substantial sums of money from the U.S. administration, did they not?
Some of them have received some funds from the administration in the past, but only if they now support President Karzai do we continue to support them.
The problem is they may say they support President Karzai, but saying and doing, of course, are two very different things. He's found it very difficult to get them to be loyal, hasn't he?
He's found some of them very difficult, but it is not difficult to tell who is supporting him, who is supporting President Karzai and who's not. And we support those who are supporting him, not the ones that just say they are.
There are some warlords who no longer receive any U.S. assistance, are there, on the grounds that they are not sufficiently loyal to Kabul?
That's correct.
Let me turn then to Kayum Karzai. Mr. Karzai, how do you see this?
Well, I agree with Sarah Chase describing the characters of these warlords and to the extent that they are impediments to the stability process. But I don't agree if she's leaving this impression that there is a deliberate policy in Washington that they want to support Hamid Karzai on one hand and the warlords on another hand, as contradictory as they may be to the to the peace process. I do believe that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda was a very complicated terroristic network that was presiding in Afghanistan, and it was a threat to Afghanistan as well as to the international community. And I believe from their demise, from the demise of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, a set of contradictory realities emerged. On one hand, we have a president and a legitimate government that was elected by 80% of the members of the Loya Jirga. On the other hand, there was a vacuum left by the Taliban, and elements of the Taliban were still around. And these guys were the only people who were armed, and they were utilized in the to eradicate terrorism.
Okay, but let me ask you this. Is it your belief that Washington is doing everything that it could do to support President Karzai, your brother, in seeking to obtain the loyalty, the unqualified loyalty, of these various warlords?
Well, here I would slightly differ. I do believe that warlords that support Hamid Karzai in the central government or does not support are not capable of being of any help to the stability process. They don't have the temperament. They don't have the know-how, and they're just warriors, and this is what their profession is. And now we're embarking on the stability process, where you need different set of human tools and different set of skills to put together the stability.
But my question, you see, was whether Washington is providing as much support as it might to President Karzai as he seeks to deal with that particular issue.
I believe that the removal of the warlords needs a very careful plan. It needs to have the larger politics in the society empowered and put in place in order to remove them. The Afghan people have grown very, very worried of war, and any war that may ensue in Afghanistan by removing the warlords is unacceptable to the people. I have been with a lot of elders and a lot of political people in Afghanistan, with the president, without the president, and their advice always was, go it slow, that they cannot afford to drag Afghanistan to another war, and time is the best enemy of the warlord. This is the advice of the people to the president, and this is the advice of the people, the consensus of the people in Afghanistan.
Ambassador Taylor, then let me turn to you and ask you this. Is it the U.S. belief that some of the regional warlords who currently have positions of power ought not to have those positions of power, and Afghanistan would be better off were they to be dislodged?
Robin, it's our view that President Karzai is the best judge of that question. He is a very good politician. He is a very good judge of who supports him and who doesn't. He's a very good student of his people. He knows his people extremely well. We support him. This ought to be very clear. We support him. If he concludes that there are some governors that he can no longer count on, if he concludes that there are some governors that should be dismissed, we will support him. I think Karim Karzai is exactly right when he says that this removal of governors needs to be done very carefully, needs to be done in a way that does not cause more conflict. The people of Afghanistan have seen much more than their share of conflict over the past 25 years, and they don't need another one that can be avoided. So we agree that some of these governors might well be replaced. And if the president decides to do that, we'll support him.
But it's interesting, Ambassador, the picture that you paint is quite different from the one that we heard from Sarah Chase, isn't it? Because she gave us the very clear impression that the people in Kandahar would very much like to see the back of the man who is currently governor of that region, that they believe that if the U.S. wanted to help President Karzai get him out, they could, and that until he goes, there isn't much chance of the city really getting back on its feet again. You say it has to be done slowly and the initiative must come from him.
We say that that these kinds of political decisions are best made by the president of that country. This is not a decision that the Americans are going to make. This is not a decision that any foreigner should make. This is clearly a decision that is right for the president of that country to make. And if he decides that governor or any of the other governors ought to go, then we'll support him. He's got resources. He's got moral authority to make these decisions and, in all likelihood, enforce them. In any case, we support him.
He may have the moral authority, but he doesn't really have the military might, doesn't he? If he were to turn to the U.S. and say, I want to get rid of Governor X, will you help me militarily if it should come to that? Would the U.S. look favorably on such a request?
The U.S. Will certainly consider any request that President Karzai makes of us. We are there to support him. I think this is very clear to him. I think it's very clear to the Afghan people that we, the United States, feel a very strong commitment. I know that at the very senior levels of this government, our commitment is strong, has been well stated, frequently stated, and fervently stated, and we do it again, that we are there to support this government. We are there to improve the lives of the Afghan people that have suffered so much. They are now on a much better track than they were before, and we want to keep them on that, and we want to support this governor, this president, this person who is governing the country, as he moves them forward. That, this is where, and if he decides he needs a change of some of the leaders around the country, we will certainly consider it.
Kayhan Karzai, you were suggesting a moment or two ago that it's better to go slow than to go fast. Is that because you and the government in Kabul fear that if action is taken too quickly, it would result in more unrest, more violence?
It is not that. The equation, the political equation in Afghanistan is enormously sensitive. The people of the society of Afghanistan, politically, economically, and culturally, has been uprooted by the warlords, and then by extremism, and then by Taliban and Al Qaeda. It is because of that that when an initiative is put together to remove a governor or a warlord, it is most important that decision is effective and it's conclusive, and the person is removed without dragging on this decision. And I believe that is why I am afraid of the psychological impact on the population if a decision is made in Afghanistan and it is not well calculated and it's not well planned, and the larger equation of politics is not put in place to definitively remove that warlord. And I believe that the consequence for the stability will be much more severe than to give that governor or that warlord to persist for 2-3 months more in that position.
Stay with us if you would. I want to take a call now. Adam is on the line from Brookline in New Hampshire. Adam, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay, thanks. So what do you make of all this?
Well, I'm glad Sarah Chase called in, so we have some different perspectives, especially from people who are actually over in the area. And my I don't know if I have a question or a comment or maybe it's a hybrid somewhere in the middle there.
That's okay.
But she was talking about how it's pretty much a foregone conclusion that a lot of these warlords are taking advantage of the situation of having the unrest, and it's not really in their best interest to just give up the reins of their power and yield to the the authorities in control there. And she basically made the point that these people benefit from the situation of unrest. Now, we're talking here about the United States administration stepping in and controlling this situation. And I wonder if anyone it certainly pops right up in my radar screen. Does it seem like it's in the U.S. administration's best interest to defuse this situation? And I know the kind of comments I'm going to get for something like that, but I mean, humans are humans, and we have the same motivations over here as we do as people over in Afghanistan do. And I wonder what people's comments are on the idea that maybe it's in the administration's best interest to leave the situation as is.
Why do you say that, Adam? What do you think the administration might get from leaving the warlords where they are?
Well, they certainly have a lot more power over here.
Who do?
The administration. With things like, as long as the threat of terrorism, et cetera, is maintained over here, it's a lot easier to hold control over here, just like it is anywhere else in the world.
Okay, Adam, thanks for that. Ambassador Taylor, would you like to respond?
Sure. It is clearly in the U.S. government's interest. I think it's in the U.S. people's, American people's interest for Afghanistan to be a stable, secure, prosperous, democratic country in that part of the world. We need that in that part of the world. We don't have enough of that kind of model of a Muslim society, of Islamic society, that is able to find its way in the world in a way that is responsible and responsive to its people. This is clearly in our interest. We see and have seen back in September in 2001 what the result of chaos and Taliban and Al Qaeda rule in Afghanistan. That's clearly not in our interest.
Okay, but while we're talking about September the 11th, 2001, you still want to catch Osama bin Laden. Do you believe that some of these warlords might be able to help you to do that? Is that one reason why they are still in power?
No, I don't think so. We have forces in Afghanistan who are tracking down Al Qaeda. And they are doing it very well. If they get some support from other people, that's fine. But we've got very great capabilities to track this man down.
Kayum Khazar, of course.
If I may jump in. Mm-hmm. I do not agree with the caller in that sense that this is a conservative Islamic society, and the stability process is only credible to them, and they have shown it through enormous dialogue with the government and the international community, because the United States is leading the stability process. And another point that I would like to make is that which is the point that Sarah Chase is making, and we totally agree on in this regard, that warlords are not helping the anti-terrorism campaign. And in fact, by warlords being in the forefront of the anti-terrorism campaign, they're sidelining the population. And the best way to get rid of terrorism, to eradicate terrorism from Afghanistan, is to empower the people to stand against terrorism. And this is the people of Afghanistan sees the fight of terrorism right now between the warlords and between the warlords against Al Qaeda and the Taliban, and they're not going to jump into that fight because both of these camps are hostile to their interests, and that is why they're sidelined. And I believe that for the terrorism campaign to go rightly and to eliminate Al Qaeda and Taliban from Afghanistan and all forms of radicalism from Afghanistan, it is very, very important that the warlords are sidelined and people are empowered and the elders are empowered to pick up the campaign against terrorism.
Okay, but that brings us back to the question we began with. You say it's very important that they should be sidelined. How and when?
It should be sidelined. There needs to be a much greater coordination and dialogue between the two governments. That is the U.S. government.
Washington and Kabul.
In Kabul. That is correct. And the second thing is that it has to be a well-planned and a clearly defined step for each individual warlord to be removed. It is not a scenario that what one size fits all. Each warlord lives in a set of unique circumstances that the policymaker would have to approach and remove them. And I believe that frankly I would say that it needs some time. It is not all that bad. Great things have occurred in Afghanistan, and the people of the culture of Afghanistan has recovered. Schools have started it. Economic activities have started.
Kayum Khazai, stay on the line if you would. Ambassador Taylor, stay with us as well. We're discussing the U.S.'s promises to Afghanistan. Does America have the attention span in Afghanistan or in Iraq? I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the U.S. commitment to rebuilding Afghanistan. The U.S. is supporting the Karzai government in Kabul, but it also seems to be supporting some of the regional warlords who are in power in the countryside. Is the U.S. hedging its bets? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Ambassador Bill Taylor, Afghanistan coordinator of the U.S. State Department, and Kayum Khazai, founder and director of Afghans for Civil Society. On the line now, Hassan, calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hassan, you're from Afghanistan, are you?
Sure, yeah. I was there last year after 20 years, and I felt that all Afghan people, 99%, welcome American military to remove the Taliban. But the warlord benefited from this involvement, you know. And also the warlords are involved in drug dealing. They make the money, and they don't care about the central government.
So what do you think then? What do you think then should happen?
Yeah, I want the United States to support the Hamid Karzai for building a national military to replace the warlords' people, which they pay them from the drug money and corruption and replacement as soon as they can.
All right, Hassan, thanks for that. Ambassador Taylor, just on the question of a national army, at the moment there really isn't much of one, is there?
Actually, there's the makings of a national army. There are the Americans. One of their major contributions, one of our major contributions to Afghanistan at this point, has been the development of the beginnings of a national army. It's called the Afghan National Army. And we've trained about 4,000 soldiers from all over the country. They are loyal to President Karzai. They are a growing force in the country. They clearly have a long way to go. We're shooting for probably 70,000 total over a period of years of training. But these soldiers are clearly trained and well-disciplined and widely respected in their country when they go on maneuvers. And they are a symbol of this country and what it can be. So it is coming, and that's one of our major contributions so far.
It is a complicated situation, though, isn't it, when the defense minister in the Karzai government is himself a man who many regard as a warlord, and who certainly, until not very long ago, had most of the equipment, which in theory belonged to the National Army, stashed away in his own fiefdom in the Panjshir Valley.
The defense minister does have control over armed forces, and these forces are going to be gradually removed, gradually dismantled, gradually disarmed, as the Afghan National Army that I just mentioned is trained and as it grows and able to take over the responsibilities of these forces. So there is a building down of existing militias and a building up of a new army that is loyal to President Karzai.
Is it your belief that if the warlords are to be sidelined, that can be done without the use of military force? Or do you believe that at some point there is going to have to be a military operation to enforce the will of the Kabul government?
I believe, I think Sarah Chase addressed this as well, and Kaim Karzai may well have a view on this. My understanding, after having spent 9 months in that country and traveled to Kandahar and a lot of other places around the country, but in Kandahar in particular, my belief is similar to President Karzai's, that there will not, and similar to Sarah Chase, that is, there will not be resistance from this particular governor if he is replaced. He may well be offered another position somewhere where he can make a better contribution than he's been able to make as governor of Kandahar. There are a lot of ways, as Kaim Karzai indicated, that this can be prepared, that these steps can be prepared. And some careful thought ought to go into it, and then decisive action. And when that happens, my bet is, in answer to your question, that there will not be military confrontation.
Kaim Karzai, is that your sense as well?
Quite objectively, Robin, I believe that the warlords have served their purpose, whatever their purpose was, and that is behind us.
But do they think they have served their purpose?
They served their purpose that they have started in the anti-terrorism campaign against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and I believe that right now their impact in the anti-terrorism campaign is negative. And I believe that one of the worst possible consequences of their participation in the anti-terrorism campaign is that they give a major propaganda tool to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and says, ha-ha, here it is, the United States is cooperating with the warlords. You see, the most important thing to realize that the population see these warlords as indigenous terrorists. And the Al-Qaeda and Taliban equally is a international terrorist that have destroyed their lives. So because of that there is a vacuum left from which the Taliban and Al-Qaeda benefit. I do believe it is time for the United States to make a major declaration that the days of politicking by warlords is over, that they don't have the temperament and they don't have the means to help the stability process. And this is how the Afghan people are quite pragmatic. They in the beginning they saw, and actually they acknowledged the necessity of these warlords being in the forefront of the anti-terrorism campaign.
Okay, but you've made an interesting point, a major declaration from the Washington government, Ambassador Bill Taylor. Is it time for such a major declaration? Can you say it tonight on this program?
Indeed. The Deputy Secretary of State, Richard Armitage, has made that declaration. He made it very clearly in public, in the papers, when he was in Kabul about a month ago, maybe a month and a half ago, and he was asked this very question. He was asked, what is your attitude about the warlords? And he said very clearly, Deputy Secretary Armitage said very clearly, the warlords have a decision to make. They have a choice. They can support the central government under President Karzai or not. If they support him, fine. If they don't, they're in for a rocky road, he said. We have made this very clear. Secretary Armitage made it very clear, and that's the statement that we are living by.
Okay, we have a caller now, Norm, on the line from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Norm, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Yes, I want to just lend a voice of appreciation for Mr. Taylor and Mr. Karzai's voices of caution in this whole dialogue. I'm the director of an NGO. We've been operating in Afghanistan, mostly in north and west and somewhat in the south and east over the last 5 years. I'm concerned about two things, both of which appear in Ms. Chase's article that are a bit disturbing to me. One is the tendency to overgeneralize warlords as some kind of a category in which they are all alike. They are not all alike, and Mr. Karzai, I appreciated your comments about needing to look very carefully at the ethnic and regional particularities in each case before we just generalize some sort of a blanket response on the part of the U.S., especially that might involve our military to dislodge the warlords. And secondly, I'm concerned about what seems to be an implication that that our response as the U.S. government and as Americans necessarily should imply military action. I appreciated, Mr. Taylor, your comments that these kinds of responses need to be guided from the government of Afghanistan and not from American political dialogue, even if we look at the U.S. military as somehow being one of the more effective arms of foreign policy. I think we are potentially in for real problems if we just blanket decide to dislodge the warlords and we don't have a clear plan afterwards or a clear understanding of what the unique and individual situations are in which each occupies a position of influence and power.
Okay, Norm, thanks for that. Kayum Karzai, 12 months from now, will the warlords still be in power?
I hope not, and I believe the stability process might not survive if they're in power for 12 more months. But I would like to make a comment about the caller's view. Quite fortunately, there is no ethnic dimension to the scenario of warlordism in Afghanistan. And these warlords have victimized their own ethnic group, and there is much more in common between the warlords than it is between a particular warlord and their ethnic group.
Okay, Kayum Karzai from Afghans for Civil Society. Ambassador Bill Taylor, Afghanistan Coordinator of the U.S. State Department, thank you both very much for being with us this evening. You can continue our conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a new leader is named for the scandal-scarred Diocese of Boston. This is On Point. Bishop Sean Patrick O'Malley, who helped to deal with sex abuse allegations in two of his previous posts, was today named as the new head of the Boston Archdiocese. Boston has been the epicenter of the Catholic Church's sex abuse scandals, and it's been without a permanent leader since the resignation of Cardinal Bernard Law last December. Bishop O'Malley was appointed the head of the Diocese of Fall River, Massachusetts, in 1992, after it saw one of the worst Catholic abuse cases, the one involving Father James Porter. In October last year, O'Malley was installed as Bishop of Palm Beach, Florida, after the previous two bishops had confessed to child molestation. In a news conference today, Bishop O'Malley said the entire church feels the pain of this scandal and longs for relief for the families and the communities that have been so shaken by these sad events and by the mishandling of the situation on the part of the church's officials. Here's more of what he said.
Reconciliation always demands a firm purpose of amendment. It means seeking new ways to avoid the grave mistakes of the past and to make the safety of children our paramount goal. As your Archbishop, I commit myself to working with you to ensure the safety and the well-being of our young people in the Church. Together as Catholics, clergy, consecrated religious, and laity, we must work to bring healing and comfort to the victims of abuse and to guarantee that through vigilance and education, our churches, schools, and agencies will be safe havens for children and young people. I know that the laity has a great role to play in this process. I am anxious to hear firsthand from the bishops, priests, parish councils, and lay leaders about what is happening and what needs to happen. We are all anxious for the financial settlements with those who have suffered from sexual abuse. We know that no amount of money can ever compensate for the damage caused by abuse. It is most regrettable that there was not more of an awareness of the great consequences in bygone days. If there had been, we can only hope that the church and the psychiatric community would have reacted more decisively in cases of child abuse. We hope that the achievement of financial settlements will be a factor in a process of healing. I have always told diocesan lawyers in the past that settlements are not hush money or extortion or anything other than the rightful indemnification of persons who have suffered gravely at the hands of a priest. Even when I have been told that there's no legal obligation, I have always said, if there is a moral obligation, we must step up to the plate. People's lives are more important than money. In Boston, the numbers of victims are great and the dollar amounts are staggering. We want to do right by the victims and at the same time to carry on the essential elements of our mission, especially our mission to give people the good news of the gospel and to serve the poor, the sick, and the marginalized. And so as the church is racked by scandal and by crisis, the stakes are very high. I appeal to all Catholics to help the Church to be a wounded healer by healing the divisions in our own ranks so that we can be a leaven for good in the society in which we live. I address you, my fellow Catholics of Boston, with those words that inspired St. Francis when the crucified Lord said to him, "Francis, repair my church." I ask you and plead with you, repair my church.
Bishop Sean Patrick O'Malley speaking today at a news conference after being named as the new head of the Catholic Archdiocese of Boston. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.